If you have your Bible or a way to access your Bible, you have an app. We're going to be in John chapter 2 this morning, John 2. And if you don't know, we've kind of started this new series going through John. And at the beginning of it, we're calling it The Beginning. So that's kind of the way the Gospel of John starts. It says, in the beginning was the Word. And we talked about the Word that became flesh. We talked about how this guy named John the Baptist came telling people that he was the Lamb of God. And today we're going to see him perform his very first sign miracle. In the Gospels, there are these seven great signs that point to who Jesus really is. Except for one problem. If you and I were writing out a life of Jesus, the story of Jesus, we probably wouldn't think to ourselves, let me make the first story in the life of Jesus, the first sign miracle, one in which he turns water into wine. It's kind of an extraordinary thing. In fact, he doesn't just change a little bit of water into a little bit of wine. He does a lot. We're going to read in a moment that there are six stone jars, each of them containing 180 gallons of water, and how Jesus is going to perform a miracle in which those are going to be turned into wine. So if you multiply six times 180 gallons by 64 ounces, and then you divide it based on an average wine serving of 5 ounces, Jesus will have made 2,304 servings of wine. I mean, that is a lot of wine. But then you also consider the fact that this is undiluted, and they would dilute it up to 10 times. He's literally made the equivalent of 23,000 glasses of wine. I mean, this is more than enough wine for everybody in Cana for a long time. It's enough wine for everybody, every adult male in Waxahachie today. This is an incredible miracle of super abundance. So what in the world does it mean? Well, I realize this morning as we come to this text and we come to this passage, we sort of bring with us our own view of this. We bring with us our own background, our own interpretation, and our own experience, and our own life to this passage and how we want to and how we think it should be interpreted, depending on the kind of family you grew up in or the way you understand the Bible and what it says about wine or any other kind of drink like this. My wife has a particular view about this. Her only memory of her grandfather who has died, the only memory she ever had of him was when he was intoxicated. It's the only memory she has of him. And when we met when she was at Baylor in college and I was at seminary, her grandfather had fallen and he had broken his leg and he was in the hospital and he died. And this was her only sort of experience of him. And then there's, on the other side of it, you got someone like my grandmother. She's 99. She's about to turn 100 in 2 months. And she will tell you, she's a lifelong Baptist. She says, I've never touched alcohol at any time, ever, at all in her whole life. But then she'll tell this fantastic story about her Uncle Gus. Uncle Gus ran liquor with Al Capone. And she has these great stories of Lefty, who he worked with. And you can go look it up. I mean, it's the Chicago gangster stories. And so, you know, we all bring to this our own view of this, don't we? And it also depends a little bit on our age. If we're on the upper end of the spectrum, we're in our 80s or 70s or something like that, we begin to look at this a little differently because we grew up under more of a prohibition period. But as you get younger and you get to like college age and you go to a college campus like Harvard, and Harvard goes out and does a study and they ask the people how many of the college students drink alcohol, it's like the study comes back 100%. So in other words, we come to this with our own experiences and with our own interpretations of this. And what we've got to do this morning to understand this is we all have to get in our own little time machine this morning, and we have to go back 2,000 years, and then we have to get into an airplane, and we have to fly to the other side of the world, to Israel, 2,000 years ago, to a culture, into a world that had its own view of what wine meant and what this miracle meant then. But before I can go into all of that, let me just make a few opening points about this. First of all, and you've got some blanks, if you've got the outline you want to follow along, or you've got the app, you can kind of write a few of these notes down, and then we'll read the text. But I want you to know that in this world, wine had a very practical use. Wine's practical use was something that people just, they regularly, many of them drank every day. Not all of them. Some were Nazarites and they didn't drink. John the Baptist didn't drink alcohol. But most people would drink wine every day. It was a part of their daily life. They would also use wine for medicinal purposes. The story of the Samaritan, the good Samaritan who stops and helps a man, he puts oil on him and he puts wine on him to help to kill the bacteria, we would say today, and help him to get better. It had a medical purpose, but also it had just a digestive purpose. Paul wrote to the young Timothy, a pastor, and it's hard to imagine Paul saying this, but this was his advice, 1 Timothy 5:23, stop drinking only water. Now, if I were giving the advice, I would say drink more coffee, but what he says is, and use a little wine because of your stomach and your frequent illnesses. So they were already thinking of it having this kind of practical use in their everyday life. But then on the other side of it is that the Bible also tells us about wine's potential misuse or abuse. It tells stories of guys like Noah when he gets off the ark and he plants a vineyard and he gets drunk and he embarrasses himself. Yeah, the book of Proverbs tells all these wise sayings about if you do this, be careful, be wise. Or as my seminary professor used to say in seminary, when you go out there and you're a pastor somewhere, just don't be dumb. That was his advice. That's good advice, isn't it? For all of life, just don't be dumb with what you do. This is Paul's advice to the church in Ephesians when he gives the command, do not get drunk on wine that leads to debauchery. That just means just all kinds of sinful behavior. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. So those are two kind of extremes, but when we come to this passage, what's really important is wine's symbolism. Wine here has a very important symbolic meaning. So what is it, and why does Jesus make this his first miracle? John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. This is only a few miles from Jesus' hometown of Nazareth. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. And when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Now somebody may be scratching their head going, now how in the world would she have known that? Well, the women's quarters was right next to the servants' quarters, and they would have been the first ones to find out. They have no more wine. Woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied. Now lest you think that this is Jesus' teenage moment, talking to his mother here. Woman. This was just a normal colloquialism. This was an expression that was very much in line with the society. Woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied, my hour has not yet come. Now, that's not a throwaway line. My hour is a very important word in this book of John. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. I love that moment. Because Jesus basically says to his mom, it's not my hour, and his mom says, just do whatever the servants say. That's what my mom would say, right? He's going to go ahead and do this because I want him to do it. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars. The stone is important because clay was porous and it was unclean, so stone had to be used. It was the kind Jews used for ceremonial washing. Each one held 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim, not halfway, not part of the way, but all the way to the top. And then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. I love that too, because we're never told when the miracle happens. You know, did it happen when he poured the water in? Did it happen while they were still carrying it? Did it happen the moment he tasted it? He's like, what are you giving me water for? He did not realize where it had come from. And the servants who had drawn the water knew. And then he called the bridegroom aside and he said, everyone brings out the choice wine. In other words, the bridegroom gets credit here. Everyone brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. So this is not non-alcoholic grape juice that we're talking about here. You have saved the best till now, or you have saved the best till last. What Jesus did here in Cana, Galilee, was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. Why? Why, Jesus? Why, John, are you telling this is the first miracle story of Jesus? Well, notice here in the story, the first big thing is the problem. Right from the very beginning of this story, the problem is introduced to us, and the problem is, here is a wedding, and they've run out of wine. Now, to us, we don't necessarily think of this as a huge problem, but in this culture, this was a big deal. The Jews had a holy book called the Talmud, and in the Talmud it says that there is no rejoicing without wine. So, like, in this culture, wine was the way you celebrated. It was what you did. It's like having a birthday party, but nobody shows up, nobody brings any presents, nobody has a cake. It's not a very good birthday party. In their culture, wine had to be there in order for there to be a joyous wedding occasion. It was necessary. And when it ran out, it was a social faux pas. It was embarrassing. It was like showing up to a black tie affair with boots on, you know? That sounds like a country song or something, doesn't it? It was a violation of something you were supposed to do, and it was embarrassing not just to the family, it was embarrassing to everyone. Oh, can you? And it would be a story that everyone would have told from then on. The couple marriage would be doomed because they didn't have enough wine at the wedding. But in this story, there's a deeper meaning. This story, as it's being told of the barrenness and the emptiness and the running out of the wine, is actually itself sort of a sign of the spiritual condition of Israel and God's people. They're barren and empty and dry. They've run out. As I look at our world today, I see the spiritual condition of our world. Maybe you would agree with me. It doesn't look so good. Maybe as you walked in here this morning, you're kind of coming to church going, to tell you the truth, I'm kind of empty. Spiritually, I'm kind of drained. I'm kind of dry. I need to kind of be filled. I need to kind of be rejuvenated. I need to kind of be on fire again for God and His Word and for living this thing called the Christian life. It's a problem. So what's the solution? And that's what happens next in the story, of course. Now, if you put yourself in Jesus' position in the story and Mary says they've run out of wine, most of us would say, well, let's just go to the wine store and get some more. What's the big deal? I mean, what's the problem? But probably in Cana, there wasn't some big wine store somewhere with a whole bunch of storage. And even if there was, it would have cost a lot of money. And even if it was, there wasn't time. No time, no store. They needed a miracle. There are moments in our lives like this. Moments when we've run out of time, we've run out of options, and the only thing left is a miracle. After I preached this sermon in the early service, Jerry Rogers came up to me afterwards, and he said, that was me. And he reminded me the day a year ago or so when he had fallen down in the creek, and he was laying there all by himself, just yelling, and nobody was there to see him. And then someone happened to see him, and we all got on the phone, and we all rushed over there. And Jerry was saved. He needed a miracle. There are moments in our life when we need a miracle, and this is a needed miracle moment. So then the question is, why does Jesus hesitate? Like, why does he even stop and think about it? Why doesn't he just go, you know what, I'm Jesus, I'm going to go ahead and do this. It's not that big of a deal. Why the hesitation? And he gives us an answer, and it's a deep insight into what's going on in Jesus' mind. He says that it is not his hour. Now, there's a new television show that's come back on about time, 24-hour, right? And the clock starts ticking at the beginning of the show, and you only have 24 hours to the end of the program, which you know something's going to happen in that last hour. The clock starts ticking. Jesus is saying something similar to that. The clock will start ticking when he performs a miracle, and the road to the cross is now going to be inevitable. It's kind of like, hey, I'm not really looking forward to the cross getting started. Mom, I really don't want to do this miracle today. Like, I'd kind of like to put it off a little while. You know, I grew up in Nazareth. Things are kind of going okay. I started this discipleship business thing. Things are going okay. I just got baptized. The cross, I'm not really ready for that. But all through the gospel, we're told again and again and again, Jesus will say that, my hour has not come. My hour has not come. John 7:30, John 8:20, John 12:23, 27:13, 1, 16:32. And then finally, on the night he's arrested, on the night before he'll be crucified, he says this in a prayer, John 17:1. After Jesus said this, he looked to heaven and he prayed, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may glorify you. Now at last, The hour of the cross has come. So that's the problem. That's the solution. But what's the significance? Like, what's the big deal about what's happening here? Why the wine? Why the wedding? What's going on? Well, first of all, the wine was itself a sign. It was a sign of something all through the Bible. Think about Israel of the Old Testament, or the whole Old Testament. God created this guy named Adam, sent Adam, and Adam failed. Then he sent Abraham. And Abraham had a son named Isaac, and Jacob, whose son was also Israel, had all these sons, and they went into Egypt, and they came out, Moses, then Joshua, they took the promised land, and the 12 tribes. And they had this wonderful land, this promised land, this land of promise, and it was full of bounty and wonder, and it was great. But God made a covenant with them. He said, look, as long as you keep this covenant, it's going to be great. And they broke it. And it got bad, and they got taken into captivity and exile. And they started longing for the day when God would renew that covenant. And one of the ways that's described in the Bible is in terms of an abundance of wine. Listen to this, Isaiah 25:6. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. Amos also spoke of this day when God would finally come in a profound way and bring in this new age. The days are coming when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes. They stomped on the grapes to make wine. New wine will drip from the mountains. They will plant vineyards and they will drink their wine. The great prophet Joel says, in that day the mountains will drip with new wine. This image of this abundance, this superabundance of wine, was a sign that now was the moment that Isaiah had talked about, that Amos had prophesied, that Joel had said would come. Now was the moment that this was beginning to take place. The longed-for prophecy was being fulfilled. But then also the wedding itself was a symbol. In the Bible, the image of a wedding is one in which God and his people coming together, right? This image of the two coming together. Jesus would tell this story in Matthew 22 about a parable about the kingdom, and he said it's like a king who prepared a wedding for his son. In Matthew 25, he says at that time the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and they went out to meet the bridegroom. The wedding is a symbol of God and his people coming together. And so at a wedding, there's the superabundance of wine. This is the time of celebration, a time of joy. But then also, the miracle had a message. And we hear it from the guy who doesn't even know he's saying it, verse 10. Everyone brings out the choice wine first and the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now, or the best till last. That's true in two ways. That's true of Jesus, right? I mean, Jesus is the best till last, isn't he? I mean, in the past, God had sent great people, Adam, Abraham, David, the prophets, John the Baptist. But in sending Jesus, he was sending the best, his own son. It's the story he will tell again and again. God has sent the very best till last. But then that's also true for you and me. He saved the best for last for us. If we're real followers, if we're real disciples of Jesus, we know that our future is better than our past. You may have a great past, a great history. You may be able to tell great stories. But when you are a follower of Christ, your future is always better than your past. Your future is brighter, it's more abundant, it's more wonderful. In fact, it's something that only God could give you. It's something that the prophets all longed for. Maybe today as you are hearing this sermon, you're thinking to yourself, I wonder if that's my future. I wonder if what he's talking about here, this better future, is my future. I wonder if I'm included in the group that gets to experience this. I wonder if I'm one who's going to be invited to the wedding to celebrate with him.